buildings have suffered some structural damage.
A potential risk of a tsunami on the coastal area.
Your God is from the underground, so when you pray, you cannot fuck around. No one will ever save you. Once you're dead, then you're dead. There is no coming back. Your God is from the underground, so when you pray, you cannot fuck around. No one will ever save you. Once you're dead, then you're dead. There is no coming back. Newsflash, the world cracks wide the fuck open, swallowing you and your homies whole. Whole notes, holistic remedies, the whole kit and caboodle. It is holier than now, digested by the earth. You have been jailed in essence, bewitched, imprisoned, disappear in the black expanse. Your God is from the underground, so when you pray, you cannot fuck around. No one will ever save you. When you're dead, then you're dead, there is no coming back. Your God is from the underground, so when you pray, you cannot fuck around. No one will ever save you. When you're dead, then you're dead, there is no coming back. Grounded, you have been grounded. Angelic limbs in flight, taxidermied into coat hangers. My son asked me if we would live. My son truthfully asked me if we would live. Carbonite breakfast cereals with a cyanide taste profile, leaving little room for imagination. Either that or nothing but room for imagination. Come on the temple of the intergalactic high command, to distract from your tomb, to distract from your tomb. A washing afterworld of reasoning and hood magic, made in the middle physics, cone straight as streets crumble, bones break as streets crumble, bones break. Mixing ash with blood as the hell is normalized. Welcome to Los Angeles, motherfucker. Your God is from the underground, so when you pray, you cannot fuck around. No one will ever save you. Once you're dead, then you're dead, never don't come back.
Hey everybody, welcome back to Grindhouse Messiah. This is Blaine back in 2018. Joined here, as always, my fantastic co-host, Justin. Hey, Justin, how's it going, man?
It's going pretty good, man. It is 2018, which is pretty insane. I did record an intro already this year without you because I posted an episode that we recorded a whopping 3.5 months ago. But this is our first real episode of 2018. Like, it's recorded in 2018 fully, and we're going to actually be talking about stuff. Kind of our end of the year wrap up. So I'm pretty stoked to kind of get back out there and actually record a new episode for the first time in a little while.
Oh yeah, man. We took about a month off, but we're ready to get back to it. Talk to a lot of great guests this year. Talk about a lot of cool movies. Talk some sleaze. Talk some horror. Talk some fun. All the good stuff you come to expect from Grindhouse Messiah. But you know, new year, new me. So
new year, new you. Actually, new year, same fucking you.
Oh, it's, but that's okay. It's still me. Hopefully, a little less fat and a lot more episodes.
No doubt, no doubt. And I mean, we're definitely gonna be at least getting the year started off right in that we have an episode dropping. You know, now what you guys are listening to. Hopefully, this is the third week of January, and then later this week we're recording, and next week you'll get to hear us have our first guest of the year, which I'm really stoked about. Blaine, who's our first guest of 2018?
The first guest that we're going to be bringing on the show is going to be a person you probably all know from his great work on films like Mind's Eye, the upcoming film Sequence Break, as well as Beyond the Gates, and that is Graham Skipper, definitely a kind of mainstay actor in the genre of like sci-fi and horror. So we're excited to bring him on the show. We're going to talk a little bit about some some films that have kind of molded his views, some of his favorite stuff, as well as discuss his upcoming film that I mentioned before, Sequence Break. So you guys make sure that you tune in next week. But before we get
and if
there,
you want to watch along, if you want to watch along, because I do want to try to be better at this and telling people that if they want to actually watch the films ahead of time so they can, you know, really feel like they're part of the conversation, we're going to be watching two classics. A lot of people listening to this probably have already seen, and one is David Cronenberg's Videodrome, which is kind of a classic to a lot of folks. And the other one is a little bit more obscure, and it's Ken Russell's Altered States.
Oh, yeah. And if you enjoy tuning into this show to hear me talk about lots of strange sexual awakenings that I've had, this is going to be a doozy of an episode because I'm a big pervert, and these are movies for big perverts. So, hey, stay tuned.
And I actually still have yet, even though I only have like what, 2 days before we talk to him, to watch Altered States. So I got to get on that. And I expect to like that, or maybe like isn't the word, I don't know, but I expect to appreciate that. So I'm really excited to take that in and then talk about it. So, yep. But yeah, so first things first for the new year is we got to thank our sponsors.
And now these messages.
Vinegar Syndrome, and today to do that, we decided we were going to each talk about two or three of our favorite releases from the year of 2017, and just highlight them briefly. So I'm going to turn it over to my buddy Blaine to talk about his first, and then I'll kind of wrap this up. So Blaine, in 2017, Vinegar Syndrome released a lot of stuff, and you, depending on, you know, the time of year, you bought some, you got some to review, but you own, like, almost all of it. So tell me, what were your favorite releases?
Oh, yeah. Like I say on every episode, I love Vinegar Syndrome. They generally set the tone of stuff I'm going to watch every month, things that I'm anticipating. And I came across a movie that I wasn't really looking for, never really had much interest in it, but because of my undying love for Maniac Cop, I had to check out their release of Adam Rifkin's Psycho Cop Returns. And holy shit, I was expecting something, you know, probably, you know, along the lines of silly, you know, of silliness, and I was not ready for, like, the weird amalgamation of early 90s comedy, bad action films, and over-the-top sleazy gore. And holy shit, man, it just blew me away. It was a really, really fun release. I threw it on with some buddies, and it was just like, just tons of silly gore, lots of like 90s nudity, lots of flat butts and big titties, and I had an absolute blast. There's no reason. Once again, I'm going to say this probably every episode as long as we talk about Vinegar Syndrome. I cannot stress how much care and restoration was put into this film, for really no reason except that they just love this stuff. And I mean, if you really want to watch something that is going to just put a smile on your face, just like kick back with some buddies, you know, drink a couple beers, you get a little high or something, man, like Psycho Cop Returns is like there waiting for you. So, but yeah, I mean, that's the number one I wanted to mention.
Before we move on, a lot of people, even if they're not familiar with that movie, would be familiar with Adam Rifkin, although for much different type movies, I think.
Oh, yeah. Because you think of Adam Rifkin, you always think like Detroit Rock City, his, you know, his documentaries he does with the great Giuseppe Andrews. You don't really think, you know, a sequel to a, you know, shitty slasher.
Well, and I heard him talk about this movie recently on another podcast, and he was saying that he had a friend, he took the movie, and he had a friend who, you know, was like, oh, Psycho Cop Returns, oh, that's cool, I love Psycho Cop. And he said, oh, do I need to see it? He said, no. He said, it's not really good. And I'm sure you could do something better anyway.
Yeah.
And basically the people who like financed it were like, no, write your own thing. We don't care. It doesn't have to do anything. It doesn't have to have anything to do with the first one if you don't want.
Right.
And he's like, okay.
And that's how the movie feels, because it's like, it takes place in one location. It's really kind of simple. It seemed like he already had a movie in his head that he wanted to make and just kind of jammed Psycho Cop into it. And I mean, I have seen the original. And one thing I do like that he carries over is, like, the terrible one-liners. Like, stuff that you couldn't even make up. Like, one-liners worse than, like, those little puns and shit that you see on Law & Order Special Victims Unit. It's just great, though, you know, like. So, I mean, it's a great piece of 90s nostalgia. Really entertaining. But I know, and one thing I did want to add is that, with my list, I'm excluding a few things that we've talked about a ton. That being like Sweet Sugar, as well as a Woman's Torment, which we're going to speak about in a future episode. But all my
I thought leaving out Sweet Sugar was just because it's not a good movie.
No, I also didn't. I shouldn't even brought it up because it makes me mad every time. That movie is fucking awesome. But hey, I know it's not Sweet Sugar, but what's your first pick from the good folks at Vinegar Syndrome?
Well, actually, a little movie called Witch Trap. And this was released actually before we became a podcast, earlier in the year. And I was able to review it for Synapse, where one of the sites I write for. And interestingly enough, the funny thing is that I wrote this review, and I basically focused my entire review on a short film that was on the disc, not on the actual film, for Witch Trap. Witch Trap was a decent little movie, Linnea Quigley, which means boobs, which is always fantastic. She looks really sexy, really foxy, in your words.
Yes, sir.
There's a guy named Clyde Talley who plays one of the main characters, a black gentleman who is a police officer. And I bring that up because he also is in the short film, which the director had done prior to, I think it was a student film perhaps, or like right out of college kind of thing. And the whole premise of the film is this guy, Clyde Talley, playing Jesus Christ. They call him JC in the film. And he is on trial. And it's called The Book of Joe. And it's some interesting little short film that I just like couldn't get out of my head. And it's all about faith and struggle. And it's totally something people should check out. Like I said, really only 20 minutes long or so. About a lawyer who had to defend Jesus, J.C. of Nazareth, they referred to him as at one point. Just a really, really weird movie that I liked. And the main feature was great, too. And Kevin Tenney, the director, he also directed, like, Night of the Demons, Witchboard, Peacemaker. So he kind of had a nice 80s, early 90s run in that kind of, you know, exploitation horror world. So definitely one of my favorites this year.
Yeah, see, I never got around to watching that one, but I need to check it out because I generally like Kevin Tenney's movies, and even more than the film itself, I definitely want to check out the short because I'd like to see him play around with maybe some slightly more serious material, because most of what I've seen, which is, you know, the movies that you've named are relatively just like fun, you know, as everyone knows from our much later than Halloween special. I love Night of the Demon. It's one of my go-tos every year. But I got to check that out. My next film that I want to talk about was one that we mentioned a few months back. And it is the film written by Ed Wood, directed by good old A.C. Steven. And that is Orgy of the Dead. Always kind of a movie I had seen in a lot of like party, kind of party atmospheres that I always kind of have fun, kind of watched it from the corner of my eye. But it always had been terrible quality. Once again, I'm going to talk about the actual like production work that goes in for Vinegar Syndrome. But this is such an amazing looking transfer. And as much as I always kind of felt like I like it, but, you know, maybe it's not that good, I found myself watching this movie probably, I don't know, 3 or 4 or 5 times, just letting the soundtrack play. And it really, like, I don't know, it's kind of crawled up, you know, to like kind of my pantheon of some of my favorite exploitation, mainly just because it's such an oddity. It's such a time capsule. It's a strange movie that's kind of just an excuse for sexy ladies to lazily dance while, you know, Criswell and gang just kind of carry a story. But I don't know, there's something about it that there's kind of that melancholy of that end era for Ed Wood and also kind of the end of this burlesque and, you know, kind of culture. So I don't know, it's a really, really interesting movie. Something that, you know, once again, like, you may not be a movie you sit down like seriously on, you know, like a Tuesday night and watch intently, but it's something that you can have a lot of fun with. And I mean, with these larger titles that Vinegar Syndrome puts out, you know, which, you know, when we talk about it in those terms, with exploitation films. I mean, Orgy of the Dead is a bigger title, something that a lot of people have seen. It's just great to finally get a good copy, something that you, that I can hold on to and be able to watch it, you know, how it was intended, how it was shot. So, yeah, just beyond anything, just the tender loving care really sold this as one of my favorite releases. I know you were a little more lukewarm on it, but you can't really deny that it looked good.
It looked great. No, and I'm not lukewarm on it so much as I don't believe it's a movie.
Yeah, which I think...
I believe it's just, you know, it's basically Teaserama
in a narrative
form. Cemetery? No, it's not even a narrative. I mean, it's just in a cemetery. I'm looking for a cemetery. I mean, yes, I know, you argued with me last time about how there's, oh yeah, there's a story. All right, fuck that. But I watched it and I think I mentioned this earlier when we talked about it, but I thought it was interesting how progressively for the first 4 to 5 women, every woman's boobs got bigger. And then right. Suddenly they got to a point where like it just couldn't get bigger, and then it kind of leveled off. But but I just thought to myself, like, that's a weird like decision to go bigger, 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 bigger. Like, it was just kind of odd. I watched part of it with my wife. She was like, okay, this is interesting. But to be fair, I've watched Teaserama with my wife, too, and she thought the same thing. Well, this is interesting. So, needless to say, it was it's not a bad film. It's just not really a film.
Well, yeah, like I did last time, I think it's a story, you know, if you everyone knows that age-old love story of a middle-aged man taking his teenage girlfriend into the cemetery on a full moon so you can write a horror short for a sci-fi magazine or whatever the hell he writes for. And, you know, have to stumble
and
across
and
an orgy of the
people
dead.
Dancing. Yeah. Well, and it's also not really even an orgy because no one touches each other. They just
There's
dance.
No sex in that movie whatsoever.
Even remotely. Yeah, at all. Not at all. But, So I'll go into my second, and I know you have a third you wanted to share, but I only have two specifically to discuss today. And the other one is a movie from 1995. It just got a release on Vinegar Syndrome just last month. And it was a surprise release title and sold quite well, and with what I think is some of the awesomest artwork that they put out as well. Just a great artwork. And before I give the name of the film, I'm gonna say a few points here. All right, the film is written by a guy named David Dobkin, who actually wrote and directed Wedding Crashers and Fred Claus, just to put it in perspective. He's a frequent collaborator with one Vince Vaughn. But prior to that, he was writing some interesting horror films, now regarded as a horror comedy, although... No one seems to, or the people who wrote it and directed it didn't seem to necessarily intentionally make this film funny. But it is. And before I go any further, I'll just tell you, 1995's Ice Cream Man, starring Clint Howard. I love this film. And you've never seen it, right?
I've never seen it. I've always passed it at, you know, every rental place. I don't know why I haven't seen it. I love Clint Howard. It sounds right up my alley, but it's like this huge glaring gap in my movie knowledge. So I'm hoping we eventually get around to watching it on the show and give me a good excuse to finally sit down and watch it all the way through.
Well, I just would like to then also note the fact that it also stars Olivia Hussey. Some other great cast members, actually, believe it or not. So it's not just, you know, some weirdo Clint Howard movie. But, you know, I mean, to be fair, Clint Howard is a weirdo, but there's nothing wrong with that.
No, not at all, man. And that guy, he's so endearing just as who – just being Clint Howard is so great to where I'm excited to watch, you know, another movie of him, you know, carrying the whole film. I mean –
And I explained, you know, before how I was so excited about it, but essentially it's, you know, a guy kills people and puts them into the ice cream and makes the customers all unwitting cannibals. So, and unfortunately, one thing I just read about, fortunate, unfortunate, the fortunate is he hasn't given up.
but apparently there was a Kickstarter campaign for a sequel, and he only made $4,000 of the $300,000 goal. So, didn't do horribly well, and this was a few years ago, but apparently Clint Howard has straight up said, I'm not giving up on making this film. So it would be Ice Cream Man 2, Sunday, A.E., Bloody Sunday. So, so nonetheless, that's my other selection. It's Ice Cream Man, a fantastic film.
Yeah, and God bless him. I'm glad he's still holding true to the cause there. Yeah, I remember when that when that campaign started. And I looked at that number. I was like, oh man, God bless you folks. That's a big ass number to have and not have already have $100,000 backing for.
No doubt. So, what's your third and final selection of your favorites from?
Go from like 35 to 37. All right, go ahead.
Okay, and my third and final film that I wanted to talk about with the Vinegar Syndrome releases is a movie we covered earlier on in the podcast, which is an episode you can go back and listen to, and that was our coverage on the great auteur and film written by Lawrence D. Folds, and that's Malibu High. This is a movie that I've always loved. I talked about it before. I've had a lot of crappy copies. It was great to get another really good looking one, and it basically is a take on the kind of delinquent girl films where she goes from being, you know, a bad student to eventually, you know, becoming this this prostitute who eventually becomes a hit woman, and it's just really fun, like batshit crazy, exploitation film that I think a lot of people are gonna have a blast with. But I've already talked about it a lot, so go back to that episode and hear us talk about it ad nauseum. But
what about
it's me, don't be keen by my face. It's me, Kazu and Mazu, run them all, all in your place. Disrupting stuff all day.
You hold the fucking thing, you touch it. I'm transdimensional, not gay.
You need a plug, we got that mother shit.
Now that we've kind of covered our favorite Vinegar Syndrome picks of the year, we wanted to talk about, you know, some movies that may not have, from 2017, that may not be our top films of the year, but movies that we actually are still thinking about, kind of stuck with us throughout the year. And Justin, why don't you kick us off and talk a little bit about this list we put together?
So we narrowed it down to five films so that we could talk a little bit about each one and not have to feel like we have to rush it down. We probably could have made a list of 10 without really trying because we both watched a lot of films this year. For me, like there were a couple notable cuts that at least one of them that we decided not to talk about that I'll talk about later in our recommendations. But we narrowed it down to five films that specifically each of them, like we've both watched all five of these. We both have been thinking about and stuck with these films in our heads for since we've seen them pretty much. And so we're going to start this list off with a film that came out the very beginning of the year and is totally a big old what the fuck movie. And it's called We Are the Flesh.
Yes, sir. And this, I want to note, was actually the first film that I reviewed for your site, farsightedblog.com. So if you do enjoy our conversation, do not hesitate to go back, check it out, and read the full review. But Justin, you're the one who really popped up with wanting to talk about this one. What was kind of your drive, and what's a kind of a quick synopsis, you know, about We Are the Flesh?
Well, for me, these aren't necessarily movies I like. You know what I mean?
Well,
they're movies that stuck with me, and this movie definitely stuck with me, despite the fact I don't know that I liked the film.
Right, and that's kind of where we deviated, because I kind of loved the movie, and it's still one of my favorite films of the year, even though I saw it, you know, right around almost exactly a year ago when I checked kind of my video diary, And I mean, what I liked about this movie was kind of just to get into the synopsis here. I mean, you follow this this boy and girl that we find out are brother and sister. They seem to have been kind of wandering like a ruined city for years in search of food and shelter. They eventually find themselves into this this strange building, and once they're there, they come across this strange old man that kind of makes them, you know, kind of a dangerous offer. You know, just kind of gives them a chance to survive, but at a great and entirely disgusting cost. But I mean, that was to me like was so drawing, was this like entire like idea of being kind of a wasteland and what people were willing to do and who this old guy was, because he gives one of the best performances that I've seen. Maybe another one of those things that just goes down in history in my mind of just like great performances of just portraying a stranger where you don't understand any motivation, if they even have any, and it's just the chaos that he creates. But I mean, what were some of the things that kind of made it stick with you?
All right. Well, I'm gonna read you an open letter I wrote to the director as part of my review.
Okay.
When I reviewed this film for Synapse, because I reviewed the Arrow release of this in January that came out, and all right, his name is Emiliano Roca Minter. And I said, "Dear Mr. Minter, at 26 years old, you've already achieved in creating the dark, fucked-up horror fantasy that many before you have worked, and many after you will work, their entire lives to create. When people discuss the cutting-edge, envelope-pushing, controversial directors of our age, like Refn, Von Trier, Corinne, No, Mike, and Clark, they're simply listing a group of crazy bastards that are reaching for what you've already achieved. In other words, you're a truly sick individual. Sincerely, Feeling Filthy in Philly." So, I wrote that immediately after watching the film. And I went out to make a checklist then of all the things in the film that you would consider being like the most taboo things in the extreme film world. You know? So, here's just some things that, that you know, are in the film. So, I wrote murder, check. Decapitation, check. Incest, check. Necrophilia, check. Weird sex cults, check. Blood orgies, check. Cannibalism, check. Unsimulated fellatio and cunnilingus, check. Full penetration, check. I also noted that they live in a fabricated womb. I'm not really sure that fits into the extreme cinema world all the time necessarily, but check on that. I don't know how to explain what I think about this film, and I have yet to revisit it another time, and I'd like to, because I think whereas I thought it was visually impressive and really just, in a weird way, a beautiful film, despite being so grotesque and depraved, it was a beautiful film. It really was. I don't know that I pulled any meaning from it in as much as I pulled like a visceral reaction to it. And what I'd like to do in revisiting it is look at some of the meaning, because one of the things somebody pointed out to me who might be a little bit more familiar with some of the geopolitical kind of stuff going on in their culture, because I'm not, really talked a lot about how it's really representative of some of the like squalor and like poverty in the Mexican culture, and I never really thought of that when watching it the first time. Because I'm not familiar with that. I mean, I'm just not, you know, and I guess I'd like to be, you know, a little bit more educated than go in and watch it again in that regard. Mostly what the film strikes me as is like a really, like, if this is even possible, a darker Yoderowski film. Because it has that same aesthetic of something like Holy Mountain in a lot of ways to me. Yet, it's especially in the sexual depravity, it's far more depraved.
Well, yeah, but all that depravity is all wrapped in this surreal, beautifully shot, but incredibly vulgar world.
Right, and that's what I mean by throwing it onto, like, the Yodorowsky kind of... There's no way that Minter wasn't a Yodorowsky fan.
Right, because, I mean, that film, I mean, it's heavily drenched in surrealism. It's a lot of Benwell you see in it, a lot of Jodorowsky, a lot of those early, you know those kind of, like, late 50s, early 60s surrealism, being kind of painted throughout. And, I mean, like, for as much as people talk about, like, what this, like, hidden meaning is within the film, there is, like, one line that stuck with me that kind of made me think, like, maybe this is just kind of nihilism for nihilism's sake, because at that one point, Mariano, the sister in the story, she says, we've chosen you by chance. Chance is the most dangerous criminal to ever roam the earth. And I thought, holy shit. Like, is this just an exercise in just nihilism? Which a lot of with most times, like, that's something I complain about a lot in kind of the extreme film world. But because it's wrapped up in this, like, strange, you know, beautiful aesthetic, I kind of forgave a lot. And I mean, but yeah, see, what stuck with me is, like, I kind of forget about a lot of the most disturbing parts, and what sticks with me is just those moments of watching, you know, the little you know, homeless dude, just him preparing, you know, the food and you know, and getting the eggs, and just being so curious of what the hell, where are we, what's going on. And I love it, because I think those are what those the brother and sister are really kind of trying to figure out as well, because there's no motivation. It's just, these things are happening.
Well, and there's also, like, it's like a bizarre, like, so I think in my original review of the film, I said that Noah Hernandez, who plays this weird homeless guy, first of all, he's magnificent. I mean, like, his performance is just incredible. But he basically is like Satan to me. Like, it almost felt very hellish. But then there's also the weird parallel where he dies and then is resurrected in this film as well. And interestingly, he's resurrected after he is fucked while dead. But that's another story. And so there's just a really bizarre inversion of the resurrection story almost in this as well. And it's hard to me to quite grasp. To me, it feels like it might be a practice in nihilism in some ways, but I think that there's something more to that. There's something, whether or not he might be practicing sheer nihilism, but there's something trying to be said by the film, and I just don't know what it is. And the thing is, like, and that's what gets me, I think, about this film, why I think about it so much, is trying to figure out exactly what I think this film is saying, if I know what it's saying. I mean, I'm not sure that it matters, because it's obviously a film that's made for what initially I felt, which was a very visceral reaction. It's obviously made looking for that. And I wouldn't say it's shock for shock's sake, per se, because I hate that too, although it is in some ways, for sure. But there's something about, you're right, the surrealism of it that makes that okay, or something.
Because to me, I think of this film, like, he knew what he was doing when he made this movie. He was making a calling card to say, hey, look, everybody, look what I can do with, like, what that film was made on, like, $33,000 or something like that.
Right.
He basically put together this great thing that was like, hey, look what I can do. And look what how far I'm willing to go with it. Because that's the – and also, like, one thing I don't want to overlook is how tight the film is as well. It comes in at, what, like, 79 minutes with credits.
Right. This is, it's barely a full-length feature. I mean,
but it knows what it is. He knows what he's doing to the point where he never overstays its welcome. By the time you've kind of been worn out, the film is ending, and I don't want to ruin it, but what made me go from liking the film to loving it is those last few seconds and what happens. I don't want to ruin it, but there's something that's such a gut punch that I don't know. It just like instantly made me go, okay, it struck a nerve immediately when it happens. And when you, the listeners, check it out, let us know what you think of those last few seconds, because I think it really is one of the...
It contextualizes things in a weird way.
Yeah, you know? It really... Like, all of a sudden, even though I still don't know what's really going on and why, I felt like I did for a moment, and it, like, stuck with me.
No doubt. And with that, we can kind of use that as a nice ending point and kind of move into our second film, which, again, is actually another one that I really pushed for us talking about. So I'll just go ahead and start about it. And why I kind of let you... summarize and explain a little bit at the beginning of We Are the Flesh is because I didn't really know how to start that conversation. So I do appreciate that. I do appreciate that because I didn't really know how to explain what happens in that film, because I'm, like I said, it leaves me so, you know, confused and unsure. But the second film is more of a traditional linear story. It's more of a coming of age story, which both of you and I tend to really love that genre. And it's Super Dark Times, which just found its way onto Netflix a few weeks ago and seems to really be getting a nice buzz. And so for those of you who haven't yet checked it out, please do. But I'll start with just kind of a brief explanation of it's a story of four kids, four young men fucking around one day. Two of them are like best buds, and one of their other friends is with them, and in turn there's kind of this other kid who's tagging along because he's a friend of a friend, you know, kind of thing. And they're just fucking around, and they decide through a course of events to take the one character's big brother's samurai sword out to the woods to, you know, chop shit, which, you know, it's totally fair. I would do that totally, if I was a, you know, early teenager, as they are in this film, right? Is that what they are? I would say they're about 14, 15.
Yeah, they're definitely like in the kind of freshman, sophomore year of high school.
Right, that's where, because the one kid is actually in eighth grade, and he's only a year or two behind them. So.
Right, yeah, so they're right in that, like, that incredibly shitty state, if you have, you know, for our male listeners out there, definitely remember being, like, 14 and 15, where you're not really a teenager, you're just, like, in this little shitty, you know, kind of limbo between being a little kid and an adult, and, yeah, man, sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt.
No, it's totally okay. The reason I found this particular film to be such a hard-hitting film for me was right around the same time that I first saw this. Something actually in real life happened near me, where a few kids, you know, went to make a weed deal, and they just disappeared. And it got a little bit of national attention, but basically the one kid who was part of who was the one that was supposed to be like selling the weed, he killed them and burned them alive in like burn barrels, and then got caught a little while later. So it was a really interesting situation because it was like one town over from me. And these kids were like late high school, early college age, you know. So it kind of mirrored the fact that because there's a little bit of discussion of some weed deals and stuff in this film as well. But for some reason, that was so fresh in my mind that when I was watching this, it all kind of became this big conglomeration of whoa. And then I've actually since watched this film and still, you know, feel the same about it. So it's not just because it was fresh, but with that, the point of the story of where I was is that, like, in the woods, they're fucking around with this samurai sword, and of course, that leads to an accident where one of them is killed. And I'll kind of wrap the plot there, because shit just starts to spiral at that point, and I'd rather you watch the spiraling and see how it goes than me ruin it for you. But there's so much about this film that just felt very real to me. The main character, Zach, and then his best friend, Josh, whose big brother was the one who had that sword that they took, are kind of like best friends, and then this situation happens, and they're kind of, you know, don't really talk much, and their friendship is kind of at odds. And then there's also, of course, because what teenagers wouldn't, you know, what story would ring true if it didn't have a girl involved who they both liked. And so there was that whole situation as well. And actually, Allison, who is the character's name, is played by a girl named Elizabeth Cappuccino, and she specifically stood out to me as a standout in the film, just feeling very real. The main character too, Owen, really as well. Like, it just felt like very real kids to me. And even, you know, to say that they're standouts, honestly, the whole ensemble really just felt like real kids. And I think that that's why, the biggest reason that this film really just sticks with me, is it's real kids doing dumb shit, and then it goes wrong, and then holy fuck. And that's pretty much the summary of the movie.
Oh, yeah, because, I mean, it being called Super Dark Times, I mean, it's all...
It sounds so cheesy, doesn't it?
It sounds cheesy, and it's so on the nose of the film, because what I loved about it is, like, when I'm looking for horror and thrillers and things along those lines, I'm looking for more of a tone or a vibe that's, like, dreadful, and oh, my God. Like, this film, when it opens, the first scene, it's someone's thrown this this... deer head in, you know, through a window into the school, or something happens along those lines.
No, actually, a deer literally runs through the window and dies.
That's what it was. But it's like, it sets the tone. It's like, heads up, everybody, nothing fun is about to happen. This is a fucking bummer. And like, and it keeps it going. And like, I love that you mentioned Elizabeth Cappuccino. Like, for me, out of everybody in the film, she's a star. Like, she's like one of those people you watch, you're like, oh, shit, you know. But I mean, I really like, I know a lot of people have had problems with how it kind of plays out in the third, in the third act, which I do think that's where the film does get a little weaker. But I'm on board. I think it still plays out pretty well with what Kevin Phillips is trying to portray in, like.
Well, and he's a first time filmmaker, and this is a ridiculously amazing debut.
Oh, absolutely, man, because I reviewed this for Fantasia Fest this year. I even wrote in there like, I love debuts, and this is a great example of, like, seeing someone who's popping up and saying, okay, this is what, you know, this is my idea, and he fleshes it out really well. And I love, like, now that we're getting older, that they're exploring kind of the era that you and I grew up, which is, you know, the 90s. We had all the 80s nostalgia, but we weren't teenagers in the 80s. We were little kids. I love seeing that. I love how they really capture how the kids interact with each other. It's like, oh, sweet. You know, like I said before, these are people there's somewhere between being little kids and adults. So yeah, let's steal some weed and a samurai sword and go and play in the woods, you know? Cause
yeah,
you know, and like just listening to, you know, a bunch of virgins try to talk about women and stuff. It's just,
yeah,
it's so like, it just, it's so reminiscent, but it also, it's kind of a bummer. Cause I remember that's the age where we all lost our innocence. And that's really what the film, even if you take out the accident or the incident of the film, you still have this entire era that's kind of like, man, this is the age when people like you and me, we lost, you know, kind of that little kid innocence. It kind of started being shitty teenagers. And I think, man, it's such an impressive film that I hope people, you know, now that it's on Netflix, really kind of gravitate to and give it a good... Give it a good push, because I don't see why this film didn't at least get a more of a limited release, or, you know, at least 200 theaters nationwide, something along those lines, because it really was that good. And,
agreed.
You know, I'm excited to revisit it, but yeah, man.
And I definitely think there's a lot of interesting implications of this film. Without, you know, I don't think it ruins the film and what happens in the film at all to say it kind of ends on an interesting note where the focal point of the story at the very end becomes Elizabeth Cappuccino, almost as the survivor of these fucking kids. It's almost like, wow, she somehow got through these fucking kids and they could have completely ruined her life. And maybe I ruined something by saying that she doesn't bite the big one, but you know, she doesn't. And I don't think that ruins the movie at all. But to me, that's very much, an interesting, I really like that, that the whole story was really told from the going on with these boys, but it actually turns into this thing where it's not really about them wholly. It's also about the people around them having to kind of survive their adolescence.
You know, absolutely.
I mean, because think about all the people in our lives who had to survive our adolescence. You know what I mean?
Oh yeah, she's like a sponge for all these guys' misery.
Right,
And it's funny because by the end of the film, I mean, like, she's like, you could tell she's like a woman now. She's an adult. She makes that transition and kind of has to bear the brunt of all their childish behavior.
Right.
So yeah, I mean, it's fantastic. It's like you said, it's available on Netflix, so there's no excuse not to watch it. But with that said, I mean, let's take a little break from the super depressing, depraved shit we've been talking about, and talk about something that's a hell of a lot more fun. It is disgusting. It's ridiculous. It is the newest installment in the American Guinea Pig series, Song of Solomon. Hey, I don't know if you remember this, but we had a certain gentleman on here named Stephen Biro, who made a lot of promises about this film on our show. And holy cow, Justin, would you say it's pretty fair to say that he lived up to those promises?
Yeah, I mean, and to say that this movie doesn't have some real serious stuff going on, obviously we'd be lying. There's real serious stuff too, but it's done in a really enjoyable, over the top way.
Oh yeah.
So it's basically you take a very serious story of an exorcism, of obviously a high ranking horrible demon, that's really hard to exorcise, and then you throw it in to really what feels a lot like, and he said this in when we spoke to him, even though he wasn't actually going for it, but he somehow got there, it really feels a lot like The Evil Dead.
No, absolutely. And I guess I may have transitioned a little strange to that. This is not a fun movie, you know? Like
no,
you said.
No, but it is. It is and isn't. It is a fun movie, but it's also not a fun movie.
It's all, yeah, but see, but to me, like, outside, this is heavy material. Just for a quick synopsis, it's basically about this girl, Mary. She sees her father commit suicide in front of her. We realize something's amiss, and then we start following kind of the saga of these priests within the Catholic Church trying to exorcise a demon out of her until they kind of reach its climax. But, yeah, it is... It's such a fun take on the possession movie, which we have had to see so many bad possession movies over the past 10 or 15 years. This one goes kind of full hog. This is incredibly gory, incredibly bloody. Jessica Cameron puts on like one of the best performances of the year, where she is like, because if anyone, you know, Google Jessica Cameron, she is absolutely stunning, gorgeous woman. She takes this role that is not flattering. She breaks bones. She vomits. She screams. She is turned up to 11 on every single scene, but plays it so well. And I mean, but let's face it, the real star is the special effects, you know, work that's in this movie. Which, Justin, walk us through some of the stuff that stuck with you as far as the gore was.
Well, you talked about vomit. Mm. The first thing I could say is she doesn't just vomit. She vomits up her fucking insides. Like, I'm talking, she vomits up organs.
Oh, yeah. All of them.
Yeah, literally the entire, like, all of them. Like, that is totally it. Like, she vomits up her entire insides.
Well, Justin, and that's disgusting, but what's more disgusting than vomiting up all your organs?
There's a lot of things.
I think it's
what are you specifically?
I think it's eating them to put them back directly after.
Oh yeah. Oh, man. I almost forgot that happened. I think I might have been blocking that out.
Oh, yeah, see.
Oh, Lord. It's extreme. Yeah. So, you know, if you're familiar with the American Guinea Pig series or Unearthed as a whole or Marcus Cook as a effects guy, it all fits exactly what you would be expecting. It's very, 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 and it's very graphic, but again, it's very over the top. There's a realism to the story in that Stephen Bureau probably did more research for this film than anyone I've ever met doing research for a film. Like when he started talking about like literally ordering stuff from the Vatican Library, and basically posing as Father Bureau to do it. Even though he didn't pose by lying, they just assumed he was and he went with it. You know, he really did a lot of research to make the rituals and the catechisms and all legit. And I think that's really, really cool, but that's the realism of it. The non-realistic, over-the-top nature of the effects is what I think pushes this into the fun realm.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And
yeah.
And being able to see this, because I know I plugged it a lot this year, but at Buried Alive Film Festival this year, we were able to project this on a large screen with top-notch sound, and it really elevates the experience because every bone break, every crack, every stabbing, every time someone slits their throat and drags their tongue out of it.
Oh my God. So wait. Say that one more time just so people don't miss that.
Every time someone slits their throat
and pulls their tongue out of the slit.
I believe it's called a Colombian necktie.
Yes, that does happen in this film. Yes.
I mean, it's just such a great experience. And also, I wanted a big shout out, to some of the guys in the movie, because you had, like, actors that I'd seen in a few other things, but really kind of shine with, like, Scott Alan Warner, who plays the psychiatrist at the beginning, as well as the final priest, David E. McMahon, who I really enjoy. They really, like, jumped into these roles and just ran with it. And I mean, big shout out to Marcus Cook, a person that I love hanging out with, who also
future guest Marcus Cook.
Yes,
he will be on this show.
Yeah, eventually. But yeah, no, they did so much on the kind of budget they worked with, and I was really glad to see it turn out to be something that I think is special. And if it plays on a big screen around you, please go out and watch it. It is a fucking blast.
Definitely. And correct me if I'm wrong, the first priest played by Gene Palabicki, is that the first priest? Or is he the second one?
He's the second one. The first
second one. Gene Palabicki's, isn't he like a heavy metal musician?
Yes, yeah. I know he plays with some bands, and he's...
And I think he's scored a bunch of stuff for Unearthed before too.
Yeah, he's. I know he's worked with them a few times doing scores, as well as a guy I'll talk about in another movie we're going to talk about with Jimmy Screamer Claws. But yeah, he did a lot on the film. Everybody played a lot of roles. You know, that's
right.
That's one thing I love about when you get a chance to chat with Biro and talk about the film was nobody in this group just came in and did a role. You came in, you did a role, you also did, grip work, you did sound work. This was a labor of love that these guys stretched, a dollar out of 50 cents and put together something just bizarre.
Yes, and there's also taking on the themes of some biblical stuff going on in this film. If you pay attention to what exactly the demon living in Mary is saying, he's actually talking about the Antichrist coming and ruling in, like, now. Like, the Antichrist is upon us. So it's also got all these overtones of this being the end of days. So there's a lot of stuff going on in this film. And yes, it's dark and has some real serious matter, but it's a fun way to experience that. And so, if you can handle some really bloody and fun and over the top gore, this has got to be a priority for your 2018, because, it's going to be getting, probably a few more, you know, theatrical dates here and there and a few festivals and things, and then Unearthed will be putting it out on DVD and Blu-ray later this year. So definitely get on it. Like, that's definitely a recommendation for me.
Absolutely. Well, hey, now that we've talked about that and we managed to not spoil it like we've done the last few films, what's the next movie you want to talk about?
Well, the next film we're going to spoil the shit out of. I'm sorry, but let me say this. I'm going to spoil it and then probably still not spoil it because it's so convoluted and argued and who knows what it's actually about. And it's about 25 things. It's Mother.
Yes, Darren Aronofsky. He came back this year, gave us another weirdo film that we got to go to the Megaplex and watch with unsuspecting families and elderly folks. And,
perhaps the most bizarre thing about the film is that it was in the fucking theaters.
Yeah, I went to the local mall, purchased a ticket, sat down next to some blue hairs, some young folks, some families out on a Thursday night. You know, they wanted to swing by after going to Sears and watch a movie with America's Sweetheart. What the fuck did they get, man?
Okay. It really depends on who you ask. That's part of the thing about this movie. You loved it. I'll just straight up say that, you know, you'll talk about that in a minute. You loved it. I didn't love it, but I didn't hate it, but maybe I loved it and hated it. A lot like how I feel about We Are the Flesh. Like, I'm really glad I saw it and I really want to watch it again, and I'm not really sure if I like it. And that's really kind of how I feel about this movie. It's now, mind you, for completely different reasons, because I'm not watching, you know, decapitations and, you know, necrophilia. Although I did watch some cannibalism. But the film is basically, without getting into any of the allegories and multiple layers of allegory that are available here, if I straight up say what the plot is, it's about a woman and her husband. The husband is a poet, a writer, and he's having trouble writing. She basically just waits on him hand and foot as they live in this home and kind of takes care of the place. And then some people arrive and shit starts to happen, and he just keeps letting these people come in and out, and she's really upset about it. And then it just gets more and more intense, whereas these people's families show up, and when their families show up, their families fight, and then more people show up, and these more people are like all different people, and suddenly there's giant parties, and then there's other things going on, and then they have a child, and then that child is essentially sacrificed, and then wars happen, and then the world ends, and then it starts again. That's essentially what happens in the story, but there's so much, everything I just said obviously means nothing, because it depends on, like, how you look at it. You know, some people read this film as being specifically, whereas the mother character, which is Jennifer Lawrence's character, the main woman in the film, where she is kind of Mother Earth, and this is like an ecological tale. Other people read it as being about the biblical God, and his the wife representing, you know, maybe people of God, or you have a whole another thing you just describe with me and discuss with me. as well. And there's just, and there's also kind of a whole lot of other religious ideas from other religions built in too. And so it's very much layer upon layer upon layer. And if you hear Aronofsky discuss it, he kind of acknowledges that all those layers are present and they're there on purpose, but doesn't commit to like one. So tell us what you love about the film, and tell us a little bit about your, and like I said, I think we're going to be spoilery in this film. What's your take on the film?
I mean, for me, like, I originally was going to see a film that I assumed was going to be kind of a play on Rosemary's Baby, the marketing. If you get a chance to look at the early early one sheets for Mother, it is literally the exact same poster as Rosemary's Baby, just with J-Law's face instead of the house. But I go and I'm sitting down. I'm kind of prepared for that. And you know, as you're watching the film, it starts out as kind of this kind of strange like invasion thriller. You have, you know, a man coming out of nowhere to kind of like settle in, and then you know his wife shows up, his children show up, and you're getting this whole bizarre feeling. And then it kind of clicked after about 20 or 30 minutes in. I was like, holy shit, this isn't a horror movie. Like, this is a wacko art film that just so happens to have, you know, the star of the Hunger Games attached to it. And a lot of what you're talking about, I mean, I agree. I think this is very much a story that's being told. I think it's kind of a history of religion. I am a big fan of Darren Aronofsky's take on Noah, which he does like he does in this film, which is also incorporate a lot of Jewish folklore. And you know, you could see Jennifer Lawrence's character as kind of the Jewish story of God's wife. And I like this idea of following her as God's, as this idea of her husband being God who's creating these people. They're showing, because he's like, he creates this man. Mm-hmm. And then eventually this woman is created. Then, of course, their children. Then, like, of course, you know, the Cain and Abel story. And then
right.
He opens his home. He wants, you know, he wants these people as the world populates and all these people are starved, in my opinion, are starved for God. They want God, but he has this obligation. So, you know, he tries giving a child, which is, you know, quickly sacrificed and devoured by these people wanting to be a part of God. And I mean, I just think that there's so many just interesting ideas at play, to where mm-hmm. you can take like any of the ways you want to look at it, ecologically, spiritually, just kind of a modern take on, you know, geopolitics. It's all there. And what I think makes this film so special is the fact that it can be all those things, and it is all those things. And
right.
And for me, it works well because Darren Aronofsky is a director that I would never describe as subtle. He has a tendency to be ham-fisted and a little too on the nose at times, but in Mother, he's able to kind of exercise this ability and kind of go wild with it. And what I thought was most amazing was that with this being a studio picture, when the reviews started coming in saying this is the worst movie of the year, this is the most vile film to ever be in the theaters, blah, 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 they said, you know what, we stand by it, and we want to be able to make films like this because there is a problem in the marketplace of films these days where, you know, back when we were growing up in the 90s and 2000, early 2000s, there was multiple films would come out every month. You had counter programming, you had adult programming, you had children's programming. Now in the multiplex, you kind of have these films that are huge. They're giant budgets. They create a lot of jobs and a lot of work for people, but they're kind of designed for everyone. Mother was a great example of a studio saying, you know what, we're going to make this counter programming for a select amount of people. It's not for everybody. But those people that are looking for that kind of experience in a theater, here you go. Here's something that, you know, you may love, you may hate, but it's going to be a conversation piece. And they stuck by it, which I will give them all the props in the world for doing. And, You know, I just think that this is something that I hope they do continue with, and it's not just kind of back some up. But studios, if they want to compete with companies like Netflix, you're going to have to start putting out more mature content, and I think this is such a major step in that direction.
Right, and I mean, and I think that coming back to this film in the future is likely for us, because I think there's a good chance that we'll be to discuss it in a longer form, in maybe relation to some other films that it ties into thematically. I think we had flirted with the idea of this film and Holy Mountain, because of kind of their takes on religion and the opposing takes on religion, perhaps, and the similarities as well. But anyway, so I think I'll probably have a lot more to say one day, because I'm going to need to watch this like 8 more times before I can quite wrap my mind around where I'm at with it. But that said, right, I think you hit on a lot of things. I think my biggest takeaway is that the god of this film is an asshole.
We got to do an episode, because I disagree so hard.
I know you disagree so hard, but you're wrong.
And we don't have an extra 45 minutes to battle it out. I think we're going to definitely have to. I want a one-on-one episode with you where you and I talk about this one, and I want to duke it out over whether or not.
Well, yeah, and I have no problem admitting you're wrong. So I will certainly do that. But there's just now, to be fair, we've had this discussion already a little bit, and I knew your reaction to that was going to be exactly what it was, and that's why I said it. But I do actually definitely feel that. But I also feel like there's a lot of interesting things going on. And it's a film that I could talk about I could talk about at great length, but I just can't wrap my mind around exactly if I like it, or I fully appreciate what it's trying to say, or if I understood it better, would I fully appreciate what it's trying to say, or am I trying too hard to figure out what it's trying to say? There's just a lot there in that, like, I think, anyone who listens to this podcast knows I've referred to the folks over at Cinepunks a few times, and Liam, who is the founder of Cinepunks, and of a college friend of mine, who I've remained, friends with since, and, he has in doing some, like, I let him, like, kind of give me some assignments back on Synapse, where we called it Liam's Film School. And specifically when we were doing films by Yoderowski, who's now come up twice in this episode, he had said to me, try not to decipher what's going on and try instead to focus on what you feel, because Yoderowski is much more about your reactions and your visceral reactions and your emotions than he is about narrative. And I think while there's a lot of narrative in this film, I think it's also a film that's very much looking for reactions and emotion. And I think I'd like to try to watch this film at least once in that way as well, where I'm not trying to follow the what's going on, but more the what I'm feeling. And I think that would be an interesting way to kind of view this film. I think you naturally do that a little bit more than I do, in how you view film, And I think that could also affect sometimes how you appreciate some of these films in a different way than I do.
Right, and I mean, and I do think that's part of the fun of us having this show, where
you
appreciate narrative, you appreciate
character
development. I don't give a shit about those things. I want to see, like, either interesting, interesting visuals, or just nonsense. But I mean, like, but I think that's gonna make for a really fun future episode. I mean,
sure.
And based on your yawn, it's probably time that we get around to the last film.
Think I was just talking too much, and I was talking fast, and I like ran out of air. But I think it is a good transition for us to go to that final film, And we specifically saved this one for last because it is the most... Wow, how you can even say this in a conversation of what we just discussed, but it's the most batshit crazy of these films.
Yes, I am currently watching this film in the background while we're recording, and I'm currently watching a young man have sex with the tumor of the woman he's with. I believe this is only the only film I've ever seen this in. What movie is it, Justin?
It is currently a Shudder exclusive, so everybody should go watch it on Shudder. A movie by the one and only Flying Lotus. It is Kuso.
Yes, sir. Flying Lotus decided to take his strangeness to film and put together a series of disgusting, ooze-filled, butthole-feeding vignettes full of some of your favorite comedians just riffing in the most unbelievable way. Mm-hmm. Basically, it's like a world of California that's been struck by a major earthquake that has created sort of a disgusting outbreak.
Post-apocalyptic outbreak of, I don't even know.
Of all the body fluids mm-hmm. that you can imagine.
It's basically what California already is, let's be honest. No, just kidding. No, but seriously, it is really like this weird post-apocalyptic disease-infested world where everybody is has experienced horrible radiation and problems and is somewhere teetering on life and sickness and health, and it's just bizarre. Body Fluids is essentially like what the film could have been titled. It's literally about body fluids. Like, that is literally what this film is about. There's really nothing else to you know. Yeah, and it's shown as a series of vignettes, almost in a weird way, almost an anthology, without being an anthology. You know, it's not... There is connective tissue throughout, but it's not, like, telling a specific story. It's telling many short little stories that are all related to the fact that this is a post-apocalyptic disease in radiation-infested world.
Right, and I'll tell you what I thought was most impressive about this movie and why I'm still watching it and talking about it is this film, he set out for a very particular aesthetic, and mm-hmm. he manages to keep that going for so long to where, as disgusting as those, like, for me, like, the first 15 minutes, I was getting a little uncomfortable, a little off-put. He understands that this is a comedy, and he mm-hmm. pushes it to such absurdity that, like, when I think back on that, what made me, like, so grossed out in the beginning of the film, like, all of a sudden, I see the context of how funny it actually mm-hmm. is, because it's ridiculous. It's absurdity pushed to, like, the nth degree. And what's really impressive is to see the kind of talent that's attached to the film. Because, I mean, not only do you have, you know, the hip-hop and trip-hop legend Flying Lotus, as, you know, billing himself as Steve in this, you know, putting this together, but you also have, you know, people like Zach Fox and Tim Heidecker, Bob Heslip, you know, David Firth, George Clinton, I mean, Anders from Workaholics,
Hannibal Buress
in my favorite storyline of the film, and I mean, it's just, there's so much talent coming together to push something that is so disgusting. I don't know, it's like, it's just stuck with me mainly because of that gross out aesthetic. It's almost like, for fans of Rick and Morty out there, when they do the special episodes where they're basically going through the you know, interdimensional cable, it's kind of like that, but with like a whole bunch more like dicks and you know, period blood, and I cannot say the word buttholes enough while talking about this movie.
What's interesting is in the year that we watched, both of us watched, and neither of us liked a whole lot, a film called Assholes, which was literally about, there's a large amount of discussion about fucking in the ass. There is several actual assholes in the film, and even a large portion of the film where the main characters are transformed into their heads are actual assholes. Even though that is all the case, there's probably still as much asshole in this film as there is in that. And that's saying something. Maybe not in numbers, but certainly in the quality appearance of assholes. Specifically, to me, the asshole, I think I said asshole a lot of times in this last couple sentences, but the one that sticks out, or what sticks out of it specifically, is Mr. Quiggle.
Oh, God, yes.
And that's probably my favorite segment of the film, due in large part to the fact that I really love George Clinton. Who plays the rapper in that segment? In the Mr. Quiggle segment.
Oh, in the Mr. I do not know off the top of my head, just to be honest with you.
His name is, I'm trying to think, Manuel
Vasquez.
That's the name of the character. It's Zach Fox, just some guy, okay? So it's not a guy I know who plays this, and then he does like a little rappy thing to summon Mr. Quiggle. Yeah, it's just, all right. So Mr. Quiggle, I don't think this is ruining anything, folks, because you're gonna find this out very quickly. But Mr. Quiggle is a large bug living in George Clinton's anus. And there's a guy who goes to see George Clinton, who's a doctor, whose name in the film, by the way, is Dr. Clinton. So they didn't get too complicated with that one. And he goes there because he is deathly afraid of breasts. And he's trying to cure it. And in order to cure it, he has to sing a song to summon Mr. Quiggle out of George Clinton's ass. That is literally the basis of his segment. I don't really know what else to say about it. There's also a female rapper who talks to him at the beginning of this. She's an up-and-coming rapper named B. And she's also in another segment where she has these, like, what would you call them? Her...
Are you talking about her, the alien creatures?
Kazo and Mazu, I think they're called, the interdimensional beings that live in her apartment with her.
Oh yeah, which you know, one of them is famously played by Hannibal Buress. But yeah, right.
They basically smoke weed. They're watching what seems to be a snuff film.
Yeah.
And then she finds out she's pregnant, and she goes to the doctor, and that's where she meets this other guy who then is scared of breasts. I don't even know what to say about it, but this entire segment, this whole Mr. Quiggle segment, from the point where you meet her and her interdimensional people all the way then through this guy, all the way through then the removal of the fetus, her abortion, I don't even know what to say.
Oh, they smoke it.
Oh, yes, they do. I don't know if they actually smoke it, but they say they're going to. Do they actually do it?
No, I think they just talk about it. And those interdimensional beings that just show up hanging out with B. I like to also point out that their names were Kazo and Mazo. And to me, that whole little section, I think... I side with you where it's like, okay, Mr. Quiggle is definitely the strongest. The rest of it kind of puts together a painting of what's going on. Mm. But that's the story that really I think is like the kind of the meat and the potatoes of what the
film. Well, and the guy is. Who plays the main guy, like Manuel or whatever his name is, he's actually with a co-writer of that segment with Steven Ellison, aka Flying Lotus. So I can see he must have written that part, and then they decided he was going to play it, you know. So it's really, you know, the long and the short of this, right, this film, is that what I just described is essentially one of the most insane things I've described on this podcast, which is saying something, not only on this episode, but on this entire show. And with that in mind, that's basically a good summary of how batshit this movie is, because the other segments aren't any less crazy. They're just different. The rapper Bus Driver is in this film in several parts, and one of the things I love is his opening, like, weird jazz scat song, where he's like, "You're God from the underground." I don't know. I just love that part really a lot. And, yeah.
Oh, yeah, because it kind of sets it up to be this, like, Grand Guignol kind of theatrical, you know, presentation that it is. And it kind of gives it this, like, fun, like, kind of, like, air of fanciness to something just simply made to disgust. And one thing that that really stuck with me more than anything else is I love the interstitials of animation. Mm-hmm. Like I mentioned before with Jimmy Screamer Claws, he does a segment as well as Aphex Twin, and just this, like, bizarre, like, transitions that create this hellish world. And I don't know, I think it's a lot of fun. I mean, we're trying to describe an indescribable film, but it's, you know, right, something that I hope, more than anything else, I want Flying Lotus to put out a new record in 2018. But if I don't get a full record from him, I want to see him continuing to make especially short films and put him out there, because he does have such a cool aesthetic. It kind of reminds me of how exciting it was to originally see, you know, Rob Zombie put out films, where it was like he had this very precise thing he wants to put out there.
Right.
And I want to see that continue to be explored and maybe a little bit more fleshed out, a little bit more mature. But I do want to continue to see that kind of aesthetic carry over into hopefully, you know, more shorts and even more features.
Right. So with that, I think we wrap our five movies that stuck with us. And I think that, that again, these aren't necessarily our favorite films of the year. I think of these movies, Super Dark Times might be the only one that's in my, like, top 10 of films as far as I like me really enjoying them. But I'm going to be thinking about all these films over and over and over. And some of them we're definitely going to be revisiting on the podcast on a longer form discussion, especially Mother, so I can tell you how wrong you are. I'm intrigued. We'll probably try to get another voice in on that conversation too at some point. So maybe a woman would be nice to hear a woman's take on the film. So, you know, so it's not just a bunch of white dudes like typically. with that, I want to transition into kind of wrapping up, because we're going relatively long, and that's okay. But I don't want to keep people too long. So I kind of want to give you some recommendations on some other stuff that we discovered this year, whether new or old. And to introduce this segment, let me quick say that I had a robust conversation, or two conversations, on both our Facebook page, which people should check out. The Facebook group is with Farsighted Network and Blog, which I never actually plug that all that often, and I should, but it's for the whole Farsighted Network of podcasts, which is growing in the next few weeks. There's going to be some announcements on that, so stay tuned for that. But as well, on our Twitter, and I got some really good, some input, a frequent poster in the group, Court Psyops, he basically said that if he had to pick one, it would be Brawl in Cell Block 99.
Fuck yeah.
Which we are both big fans of, really brutal, really violent. And I expect we're going to talk about that a little bit more, because one of the, small, like, bit players in that film, a guy named Mustafa Shakur, is going to appear on the podcast in the next couple months, when he's got time in between shooting freaking the next season of Luke Cage and the other amazing things he's working on. So, that film is a transformative Vince Vaughn role. Really, really interesting film, all said and done. A few people also mentioned Yoderowski's latest, Endless Poetry, which you were a really big fan of. I was as well. And it just a really interesting film for sure.
Oh yeah. No, I mean, Endless Poetry is in my top 10 for the year. Something that, you know, oh, hopefully, I know I've already done a recommendation on it, so you guys have heard me talk about it before, but yeah, absolutely stunning, beautiful film.
Doug Tilley, who writes for the website and hosts about 10 podcasts and does a few other things, he said Low Life, which everyone should go listen to the Low Life episode we did with director Ryan Prowse. We talked about a couple of the films that inspired him. We talked about his film, and that's a it's one of my favorites of the year as well. Liam O'Donnell said the same. So Low Life, we're both big fans of that film.
Oh, yeah. No, I mean, Low Life was a big film. It's going to be a huge movie for 2018.
Right. I know it's technically a 2018 movie, I guess, because it hasn't really got did it get any kind of theatrical? I guess it just played some festivals.
Yeah, it only played a handful of festivals, got gobbled up pretty quick by IFC to be released right this year. So I think they're planning on a release date sometime in early February. So
I think that's going to be an IFC midnight release.
It is, man. You already got the Tarantino stamp of approval, so it's probably going to blow
up
everywhere.
Yeah, he said it was his favorite, one of his favorite movies of the year, I believe. So it's going to be all over the place. And remember, we talked to Ryan before almost anybody else did. So we're on the ball, man. You should check out our episode. But I don't want to take anything away from Ryan. Ryan's awesome. Really good dude. Really, really happy for him. You know, I got a bunch of people, Elise Shawakins, Mordecai Jones, a few other people that frequent the Facebook group. We're big Get Out fans. Several mentioned Mother as well. Our writer, Damian Blade, real big, a little bit more mainstreamy in his selections, but a lot, he loves horror. And Split, Black Hood's Daughter, Annabelle Creation, It, and Jeepers Creepers, three were his. And I mean, he named a few movies I really love and a few I haven't seen yet. So, you know, again, some good recommendations there. And over on Twitter, I can't even go into just how many people responded. That was just on the Facebook group. We got a ton of people over on the Twitter. Garrett said Good Time. A few other people said Good Time as well. Garrett's going to be on the podcast. He writes for our website, Garrett Smith. He'll be on the podcast in the coming months. Great dude. His podcast partner, Dan Scully, also recommended Good Time. I mentioned The Lore, which we were going to talk about maybe, but we had to bump. Our list kept getting too long of movies to talk about today. So that's a film I absolutely love. Kieran, who is why am I going blank on Kieran's last name?
Oh man, Kieran, one of my favorite writers,
our Scottish writer friend. Kieran's awesome, and he is at Hair Everywhere on Twitter. Great writer, just an awesome dude. He had some really good recommendations, but Good Time and Brawl were the ones that he really liked, suggested, and Mother as well. But he knew we were already talking about Mother. My Beautiful Island got some recommendations by our own Rachel, who writes for the website and was on our belated Halloween episode. Madeline from Puff, she said The Evil Within and Belko Experiment are two of her favorites. So we really got a really big variety. And, you know, feel free to go jump in over at Grind Messiah or over at the Facebook group, and I'll link both of them and join our conversation. We always want recommendations of stuff to check out, and so that was kind of the stuff that other people suggested. But I also I wanted one that I really wanted to highlight. I just mentioned, which was Lore. You saw The Lore, right?
I did, man. That was a really surprising movie because on paper it sounded like something I was gonna hate.
Right.
I kind of hate fairy tale kind of movies. I hate whimsy a lot of times, and musicals.
I wouldn't say
especially.
It was really heavy on whimsy.
It was not. I was so happy with what I got. I got a really smart, mature take on on the story.
And weirdly, maybe the most faithful adaptation of Little Mermaid ever put to film. Think about that.
Absolutely, and God, it was just. I loved the way it was shot. I loved all the handheld camera work. And, man, I was kind of floored because I was caught off guard by it.
Right, and so that's my big recommendation of things to check out. I mentioned some other things earlier this year that were my first time watches. I got to see Fight of My Life for the first time because you sent me a copy of that, and we're going to definitely be tackling that film on a future podcast. Definitely some other really interesting stuff that I got to see for the first time this year. I was introduced to Lucifer Valentine for the first time this year. I watched a film of his, and some good and not great things. And the lore would definitely be my top other recommendation for the year. And how about you, Blaine?
Yeah, I mean, for me, I saw a lot of movies. 2017 was really good. Just we got to cover a lot of film festivals. Got to program a film festival myself, where I actually came across this particular movie I want to highlight. It really didn't fit the program of what we were putting together, but I didn't want to overlook it at all, just because it was just, to me, so one of a kind. And that is the Icelandic film from, I'm gonna butcher this. You know, I know everyone likes to laugh at how I pronounce foreign names, but Erlingur Throdinson. I know it's so bad, but it's called The Rift. It is about.
Oh, you have a great review of that on our site, I believe.
Yes, I reviewed it for the site. I was so excited after watching it, and I at least wanted to kind of throw my two cents and try to promote it as much as I could. With a name like Rift, it's not easy to you know, just Google and come across it. And as generic as that title is, it's incredibly poignant to the story itself. And what makes it so interesting is that it is you know, an entry into queer cinema with a really smart and kind of touching thriller about two men who were involved with each other at some time, and kind of this haunting story about the two of them just kind of drifting apart, and what happens when you do break up with someone. And you know, it frames it in this like kind of beautiful story of kind of these low key haunted films, you know, where there is kind of this sub story. They talk a lot about, you know, regressive memories and what it takes to like open up to someone else. And Rift is just, I think it's incredibly great. And if nothing else, it has such beautiful fucking photography in it. It should be a commercial for Iceland, because all I saw the whole time I was watching, I was thinking, my God, I need to go to this place. So yeah, right. It's currently released on VOD right now. So you can go to like Vudu or Amazon and watch it. I think it's relatively cheap, like $3 rental. But yeah, it's really worth taking a look at.
I think it's supposed to be getting a release date side this year on Blu-ray and DVD as well, if I remember correctly.
Yes, I'm blanking on the name of the company, but they release a lot of queer cinema. I have to admit, I was really surprised that it didn't get more attention, being that it was, you know, a film about, you know, gay characters in kind of a, I guess you could kind of call it Lovecraftian in some ways. But yeah, I mean, when you go in to watch it, I do want to warn people, it's not really a horror film. It's definitely more of a dark drama, but yeah, it's absolutely beautiful, incredibly well acted and written. So yeah, so that's my suggestion, and hope you guys dig it.
Yeah, so definitely check out The Rift, check out the lore, check out the five films we talked about, and all the ones that our friends and listeners contributed as well. And you know, make sure you don't forget about all the great stuff that 2017 gave to us, as we start getting all this new great stuff in 2018. So thanks a lot for listening, and we'll be back next week with Graham Skipper and some, like I said, check out, you know, Altered States and Videodrome if you want to kind of play along at home. And we really appreciate it, guys. Keep listening, and we'll have some more announcements of some other cool stuff coming up when we talk to you next week.
Yes, sir. Well, thank you guys again. Another thank you to our sponsors over at Vinegar Syndrome. And we will see you folks next week. Peace. Błębina.
pominiętych, nadal single płytach. Dzisiaj wybierasz a. Miłości. Krople złapać w szale zachłonności. Czary Mary.
Gorycz w ustach jest przyjemna.
Nie masz pary.
Już wiem, że miłość jest bezwzględna.
Czary Mary.
Gorycz w ustach jest przyjemna.
Nie masz pary.
Już wiem, że miłość jest bezwzględna.
Czary Mary.
Gorycz w ustach jest przyjemna.
Nie masz pary.
Już wiem, że miłość jest bezwzględna.
Czary Mary.
Gorycz w ustach jest przyjemna.
Nie masz pary.
Już wiem, że miłość jest bezwzględna.